Was he aware of the habits of the patron whose sight terrified him? Had he been to the filthy rooming house, delivered an envelope there? Jason pressed his hand to his forehead and shut his eyes. Why can't I remember? When will the mists clear? Will they ever clear? Don't crucify yourself. Bourne opened his eyes, fixing them on the blonde man. For the briefest of moments, he nearly burst out laughing. He had been presented with his exit visa from Zurich, and instead of recognizing it, he was wasting time tormenting himself. He put the billfold in his pocket, wedging it behind the Marquis de Chamfort's, picked up the gun and shoved it into his belt, then dragged the unconscious figure over to the bed. A minute later, the man was strapped to the sagging mattress, gagged by a torn sheet wrapped around his face. He would remain where he was for hours, and in hours, Jason would be out of Zurich, compliments of a perspiring fat man. He had slept in his clothes. There was nothing to gather up or carry except his topcoat. He put it on and tested his leg, somewhat after the fact, he reflected. In the heat of the past few minutes, he had been unaware of the pain. It was there, as the limp was there, but neither immobilized him. The shoulder was not in as good shape. A slow paralysis was spreading. He had to get to a doctor. His head. He did not want to think about his head. He walked out into the dimly lit hallway, pulled the door closed, and stood motionless, listening. There was a burst of laughter from above. He pressed his back against the wall, gun poised. The laughter trailed off. It was a drunk's laughter, incoherent, pointless. He limped to the staircase, held on to the railing, and started down. He was on the third floor of the four-story building, having insisted on the highest room when the phrase high ground had come to him instinctively. Why had it come to him? What did it mean in terms of renting a filthy room for a single night? Sanctuary? Stop it. He reached the second floor landing, creaks in the wooden staircase accompanying each step. If the manager came out of his flat below to satisfy his curiosity, it would be the last thing he satisfied for several hours. A noise. A scratch. Soft fabric moving briefly across an abrasive surface. Cloth against wood. Someone was concealed in the short stretch of hallway between the end of one staircase and the beginning of another. Without breaking the rhythm of his walk, he peered into the shadows. There were three recessed doorways in the right wall, identical to the floor above. In one of them, he took a step closer. Not the first. It was empty. And it would not be the last, the bordering wall forming a cul-de-sac, no room to move. It had to be the second. Yes, the second doorway. From it, a man could rush forward to his left or right, or throwing a shoulder into an unsuspecting victim, send his target over the railing, plunging down the staircase. Bourne angled to his right, shifting the gun to his left hand and reaching into his belt for the weapon with a silencer. 2 feet from the recessed door, he heaved the automatic in his left hand into the shadows as he pivoted against the wall.
Was ist?
An arm appeared. Jason fired once, blowing the hand apart.
Ah!
The figure lurched out in shock, incapable of aiming his weapon. Bourne fired again, hitting the man in the thigh. He collapsed on the floor, writhing, cringing. Jason took a step forward and knelt, his knee pressing into the man's chest, his gun at the man's head. He spoke in a whisper.
Is there anyone else down there?
Nein!
Said the man, wincing in pain.
Zwei! 2 of us only! We were paid!
By whom?
You know.
A man named Carlos?
I will not answer that. Kill me first.
How did you know I was here?
Czernak.
He's dead.
Now? Not yesterday. Word reached Zurich. You were alive. We checked everyone. Everywhere. Czernak knew.
Bourne gambled.
You're lying. He pushed the gun into the man's throat. I never told Chernak about the Stepdeckstrasse. The man winced again, his neck arched.
Perhaps you did not have to.
It's a Nazi pig at informers everywhere. Why should the Stepdeckstrasse be any different?
He could describe you. Who else could?
A man at the Drei Alpenhäuser.
We never heard of any such man.
Who's we? The man swallowed, his lips stretched in pain.
Businessmen. Only businessmen.
And your service is killing.
You're a strange one to talk.
But nine.
You were to be taken, not killed.
Where?
We would be told by radio. Car frequency.
Terrific, said Jason flatly. You're not only second rate, you're accommodating. Where's your car?
Outside.
Give me the keys. The radio would identify it. The man tried to resist. He pushed Bourne's knee away and started to roll into the wall.
Nine!
You haven't got a choice. Jason brought the handle of the pistol down on the man's skull. The Swiss collapsed. Bourne found the keys. There were three in a leather case, took the man's gun and put it into his pocket. It was a smaller weapon than the one he held in his hand and had no silencer, lending a degree of credence to the claim that he was to be taken, not killed. The blonde man upstairs had been acting as the point, and therefore needed the protection of a silenced gunshot should wounding be required. But an unmuffled report could lead to complications. The Swiss on the second floor was a backup, his weapon to be used as a visible threat. Then why was he on the second floor? Why hadn't he followed his colleague? On the staircase? Something was odd. But there was no accounting for tactics, nor the time to consider them. There was a car outside on the street, and he had the keys for it. Nothing could be disregarded. The third gun. He got up painfully and found the revolver he had taken from the Frenchman in the elevator at the Gemeinschaft Bank. He pulled up his left trouser leg and inserted the gun under the elasticized fabric of his sock. It was secure. He paused to get his breath and his balance, then crossed to the staircase, aware that the pain in his left shoulder was suddenly more acute, the paralysis spreading more rapidly. Messages from brain to limb were less clear. He hoped to God he could drive. He reached the fifth step and abruptly stopped, listening as he had listened barely a minute ago for sounds of concealment. There was nothing. The wounded man may have been tactically deficient, but he had told the truth. Jason hurried down the staircase. He would drive out of Zurich, somehow, and find a doctor somewhere. He spotted the car easily. It was different from the other shabby automobiles on the street. An outsized, well-kept sedan, and he could see the bulge of an antenna base riveted into the trunk. He walked to the driver's side and ran his hand around the panel and left front fender. There was no alarm device. He unlocked the door, then opened it, holding his breath in case he was wrong about the alarm. He was not. He climbed in behind the wheel, adjusting his position until he was as comfortable as he could be, grateful that the car had an automatic shift. The large weapon in his belt inhibited him. He placed it on the seat beside him, then reached for the ignition, assuming the key that had unlocked the door was the proper one. It was not. He tried the one next to it, but it too would not fit. For the trunk, he assumed. It was the third key. Or was it? He kept stabbing at the opening. The key would not enter. He tried the second again. It was blocked. Then the first. None of the keys would fit into the ignition. Or were the messages from brain to limb to fingers too garbled, his coordination too inadequate? God damn it! Try again! A powerful light came from his left, burning his eyes, blinding him. He grabbed for the gun, but a second beam shot out from the right. The door was yanked open, and a heavy flashlight crashed down on his hand. another hand taking the weapon from the seat.
Get out!
The order came from his left, the barrel of a gun pressed into his neck. He climbed out, a thousand coruscating circles of white in his eyes. As vision slowly came back to him, the first thing he saw was the outline of two circles. Gold circles. The spectacles of the killer who had hunted him throughout the night. The man spoke.
They say in the laws of physics that every action has an equal and opposite reaction. The behavior of certain men under certain conditions is similarly predictable. For a man like you, one sets up a gauntlet, each combatant told what to say if he falls. If he does not fall, you are taken. If he does, you are misled, lulled into a false sense of progress.
It's a high degree of risk, said Jason, for those in the gauntlet.
They're paid well. And there's something else. No guarantee, of course, but it's there. The enigmatic Bourne does not kill indiscriminately. Not out of compassion, naturally, but for a far more practical reason. Men remember when they've been spared. He infiltrates the armies of others. Refined guerrilla tactics applied to a sophisticated battleground. I commend you.
You're a horse's ass. It was all Jason could think to say. But both your men are alive, if that's what you want to know. Another figure came into view, led from the shadows of the building by a short, stocky man. It was the woman. It was Marie Saint-Jacques.
That's him,
she said softly, her look unwavering.
Oh, my God.
Bourne shook his head in disbelief. How was it done, doctor? He asked her, raising his voice. Was someone watching my room at the Carillon? Was the elevator timed? The others shut down?
You're very convincing.
And I thought you were going to crash into a police car.
As it turned out, she replied, it wasn't necessary. These are the police.
Jason looked at the killer in front of him. The man was adjusting his gold spectacles.
I commend you, he said.
A minor talent, answered the killer.
The conditions were right. You provided them.
What happens now? The man inside said I was to be taken, not killed.
You forget.
He was told what to say.
The Swiss paused.
So this is what you look like. Many of us have wandered during the past 2 or 3 years. How much speculation there's been. How many contradictions. He's tall, you know. No, he's of medium height. He's blonde. No, he has dark black hair. Very light blue eyes, of course. No, quite clearly they are brown. His features are sharp. No, they're really quite ordinary. Can't pick him out in the crowd. But nothing was ordinary. It was all extraordinary. Your features have been softened, the character submerged. Change your hair, you change your face. Certain types of contact lenses are designed to alter the color of the eyes. Wear glasses, you're a different man. Visas, passports, switched at will.
The design was there. Everything fit. Not all the answers, but more of the truth than he wanted to hear.
I'd like to get this over with, said Marie Saint-Jacques, stepping forward. I'll sign whatever I have to sign. At your office, I imagine. But then I really must get back to the hotel. I don't have to tell you what I've been through tonight.
The Swiss glanced at her through his gold-rimmed glasses. The stocky man who had led her out of the shadows took her arm. She stared at both men, then down at the hand that held her, then at Bourne. Her breathing stopped, a terrible realization becoming clear. Her eyes grew wide. Let her go, said Jason. She's on her way back to Canada. You'll never see her again.
Be practical, Bourne. She's seen us. We two are professionals. There are rules.
The man flicked his gun up under Jason's chin, the barrel pressed once more into Bourne's throat. He ran his left hand about his victim's clothes, felt the weapon in Jason's pocket, and took it out.
I thought as much, he said, and turned to the stocky man.
Take her in the other car. The Limmat.
Bourne froze. Marie Saint-Jacques was to be killed, her body thrown into the Limmat River.
Wait a minute.
Jason stepped forward. The gun was jammed into his neck, forcing him back into the hood of the car.
You're being stupid. She works for the Canadian government. They'll be all over Zurich.
Why should that concern you? You won't be here.
Because it's a waste, cried Bourne. We're professionals, remember?
You bore me.
The killer turned to the stocky man.
Geh, schnell, geh's on key. Scream your goddamn head off, shouted Jason. Start yelling. Don't stop.
She tried. The scream cut short by a paralyzing blow to her throat. She fell to the pavement as her would-be executioner dragged her toward a small, nondescript black sedan.
That was stupid, said the killer,
peering through his gold-rimmed spectacles into Bourne's face.
You only hasten the inevitable. On the other hand, it will be simpler now. I can free a man to tend to our wounded. Everything's so military, isn't it? It really is a battlefield.
He turned to the man with the flashlight.
Signal Johann to go inside. He'll come back for them.
The flashlight was switched on and off twice. A fourth man, who had opened the door of the small sedan for the condemned woman, nodded. Marie Saint-Jacques was thrown into the rear seat. The door slammed shut. The man named Johann started for the concrete steps, nodding now at the executioner. Jason felt sick as the engine of the small sedan was gunned and the car bolted away from the curb into the Stepdeckstrasse, the twisted chrome bumper disappearing into the shadows of the street. Inside that car was a woman he had never seen in his life before 3 hours ago, and he had killed her.
You don't lack for soldiers, he said. If there were 100 men I could trust, I'd pay them willingly. As they say, your reputation precedes you.
Suppose I paid you. You were at the bank. You know I've got funds.
Probably millions. But I wouldn't touch a franc note.
Why? Are you afraid?
Most assuredly. Wealth is relative to the amount of time one has to enjoy it. I wouldn't have 5 minutes.
The killer turned to his subordinate.
Put him inside. Strip him. I want photographs taken of him naked, before and after he leaves us. You'll find a great deal of money on him. I want him holding it.
I'll drive.
He looked again at Bourne.
Carlos will get the first print, and I have no doubt that I'll be able to sell the others quite profitably on the open market. Magazines pay outrageous prices.
Why should Carlos believe you? Why should anyone believe you?
You said it. No one knows what I look like. I'll be covered, said the Swiss. Sufficient unto the day. Two Zurich bankers will step forward identifying you as one Jason Bourne. The same Jason Bourne who met the excessively rigid standards set by Swiss law for the release of a numbered account.
It will be enough.
He spoke to the gunman.
Hurry! I have cables to send. Debts to collect.
A powerful arm shot over Bourne's shoulder, vicing his throat in a hammerlock. The barrel of a gun was jolted into his spine, pain spreading throughout his chest as he was dragged inside the sedan. The man holding him was a professional. Even without his wounds, it would have been impossible to break the grip. The gunman's expertise, however, did not satisfy the bespectacled leader of the hunt. He climbed behind the wheel and issued another command. "Break his fingers," he said. The armlock briefly choked off Jason's air as the barrel of the gun crashed down repeatedly on his hand. Hands. Instinctively, Bourne had swung his left hand over his right, protecting it. As the blood burst from the back of his left, he twisted his fingers, letting it flow between them until both hands were covered. He choked his screams. The grip lessened. He shouted,
"My hands! They're broken!"
"Gut." But they were not broken. The left was damaged to the point where it was useless. Not the right. He moved his fingers in the shadows. His hand was intact. The car sped down the Stepdeckstrasse and swung into a side street, heading south. Jason collapsed back in the seat, gasping. The gunman tore at his clothes, ripping his shirt, yanking at his belt. In seconds, his upper body would be naked. Passport, papers, cards, money no longer his, all the items intrinsic to his escape from Zurich taken from him. It was now, or it was not to be. He screamed.
"My leg! My goddamned leg!"
He lurched forward, his right hand working furiously in the dark, fumbling under the cloth of his trouser leg. He felt it, the handle of the revolver.
"Nein!"
roared the professional in the front.
"Watch him!"
He knew. It was instinctive knowledge. It was also too late. Bourne held the gun in the darkness of the floor. The powerful soldier pushed him back. He fell with the blow, the revolver, now at his waist, pointed directly at his attacker's chest. He fired twice. The man arched backward. Jason fired again, his aim sure, the heart punctured. The man fell over into a recessed jump seat.
"Put it down," yelled Bourne, swinging the revolver over the rounded edge of the front seat, pressing the barrel into the base of the driver's skull.
"Drop it!" His breathing erratic, the killer let the gun fall.
"We will talk," he said, gripping the wheel. "We are professionals. We will talk."
The large automobile lurched forward, gathering speed, the driver increasing pressure on the accelerator.
"Slow down."
"What is your answer?"
The car went faster. Ahead were the headlights of traffic. They were leaving the Stepdeckstrasse district, entering the busier city streets.
"You want to get out of Zurich? I can get you out. Without me, you can't. All I have to do is spin the wheel. Crash into the pavement. I have nothing whatsoever to lose, Herr Bourne. There are police everywhere up ahead. I don't think you want the police."
"We'll talk," lied Jason.
Everything was timing, split-second timing. There were now two killers in a speeding enclosure that was in itself a trap. Neither killer was to be trusted. Both knew it. One had to make use of that extra half-second the other would not take. Professionals.
"Put on the brakes," said Bourne. "Drop your gun on the seat next to mine."
Jason released the weapon. It fell on top of the killers, the ring of heavy metal proof of contact.
"Done."
The killer took his foot off the accelerator, transferring it to the brake. He applied the pressure slowly, then in short stabs so that the large automobile pitched back and forth. The jabs on the pedal would become more pronounced. Bourne understood this. It was part of the driver's strategy. Balance, a factor of life and death. The arrow on the speedometer swung left. 30 kilometers. 18 kilometers. 9 kilometers. They had nearly stopped. It was the moment for the extra half-second of effort. Balance a factor. Life in balance. Jason grabbed the man by the neck, clawing at his throat, yanking him up off the seat. Then he raised his bloody left hand and thrust it forward, smearing the area of the killer's eyes. He released the throat, surging his right hand down toward the guns on the seat. Bourne gripped a handle, shoving the killer's hand away. The man screamed. his vision blurred, the gun out of reach. Jason lunged across the man's chest, pushing him down against the door, elbowing the killer's throat with his left arm, grabbing the wheel with his bloody palm. He looked up through the windshield and turned the wheel to the right, heading the car toward a pyramid of trash on the pavement. The automobile plowed into the mound of debris, a huge somnambulant insect crawling into garbage, its appearance belying the violence taking place inside its shell. The man beneath him lunged up, rolling on the seat. Bourne held the automatic in his hand, his fingers jabbing for the open space of the trigger. He found it. He bent his wrist and fired. His would-be executioner went limp, a dark red hole in his forehead. In the street, men came running toward what must have looked like a dangerously careless accident. Jason shoved the dead body across the seat and climbed over behind the wheel. He pushed the gear shift into reverse. The sedan backed awkwardly out of the debris, over the curb and into the street. He rolled down his window, calling out to the would-be rescuers as they approached. "Sorry. Everything's fine. Just a little too much to drink." A small band of concerned citizens broke up quickly, a few making gestures of admonition, others running back to their escorts and companions. Bourne breathed deeply, trying to control the involuntary trembling that seized his entire body. He pulled the gear into drive. The car started forward. He tried to picture the streets of Zurich from a memory that would not serve him. He knew vaguely where he was, where he had been, and more important, he knew more clearly where the Gison Key was in relationship to the Limmat.
"Gach! Schnell! Gison Key!"
Marie Saint-Jacques was to be killed on the Gison Key, her body thrown into the river. There was only one stretch where the Gison and the Limmat met. It was at the mouth of Lake Zurich, at the base of the western shore. Somewhere in an empty parking lot or a deserted garden overlooking the water, a short, stocky man was about to carry out an execution ordered by a dead man. Perhaps by now the gun had been fired, or a knife plunged into its mark. There was no way to know. But Jason knew he had to find out. Whoever and whatever he was, he could not walk away blindly. The professional in him, however, demanded that he swerve into the dark, wide alley ahead. There were two dead men in the car. They were a risk and a burden he could not tolerate. The precious seconds it would take to remove them could avoid the danger of a traffic policeman looking through the windows and seeing death. 32 seconds was his guess. It had taken less than a minute to pull his would-be executioners from the car. He looked at them as he limped around the hood to the door. They were curled up obscenely next to one another against a filthy brick wall. In darkness. He climbed behind the wheel and backed out of the alley.
"Gech! Schnell! Gison Key!"
Chapter 9. He reached an intersection. The traffic light read. Lights. On the left, several blocks east, he could see lights arching gently into the night sky. A bridge. The Limmat. The signal turned green. He swung the sedan to the left. He was back on the Bahnhofstrasse. The start of the Gison Key was only minutes away. The wide avenue curved around the water's edge, riverbank and lakefront merging. Moments later, on his left was the silhouetted outline of a park, in summer a stroller's haven, now dark, devoid of tourists and Zurichers. He passed an entrance for vehicles. There was a heavy chain across the white pavement, suspended between two stone posts. He came to a second, another chain prohibiting access. But it was not the same. Something was different. Something odd. He stopped the car and looked closer, reaching across the seat for the flashlight he had taken from his would-be executioner. He snapped it on and shot the beam over the heavy chain. What was it? What was different? It was not the chain. It was beneath the chain. On the white pavement kept spotless by maintenance crews. There were tire marks at odds with the surrounding cleanliness. They would not be noticed during the summer months. They were now. It was as if the filth of the Stepdeckstrasse had traveled too well. Born switched off the flashlight and dropped it on the seat. The pain in his battered left hand suddenly fused with the agony in his shoulder and his arm. He had to push all pain out of his mind. He had to curtail the bleeding as best he could. His shirt had been ripped. He reached inside and ripped it further, pulling out a strip of cloth which he proceeded to wrap around his left hand, knotting it with teeth and fingers. He was as ready as he would ever be. He picked up the gun, his would-be executioner's gun, and checked the clip. Full. He waited until two cars had passed him, then extinguished the headlights and made a U-turn, parking next to the chain. He got out, instinctively testing his leg on the pavement, then favoring it as he limped to the nearest post and lifted the hook off the iron circle protruding from the stone. He lowered the chain, making as little noise as possible, and returned to the car. He pulled at the gear shift, gently pressed the accelerator, then released it. He was now coasting into the wide expanse of an unlit parking area, made darker by the abrupt end of the white entrance road and the start of a field of black asphalt. Beyond, 200-odd yards in the distance, was the straight dark line of the seawall, a wall that contained no sea, but instead the currents of the Limmat as they poured into the waters of Lake Zurich. Farther away were the lights of the boats, bobbing in stately splendor. Beyond these were the stationary lights of the old city, the blurred floodlights of darkened piers. Jason's eyes took everything in, for the distance was his backdrop. He was looking for shapes in front of it. To the right. The right. A dark outline darker than the wall, an intrusion of black on lesser black. Obscure, faint, barely discernible, but there, 100 yards away. Now 90. 85. He cut off the engine and brought the car to a stop. He sat motionless by the open window, staring into the darkness, trying to see more clearly. He heard the wind coming off the water. It covered any sound the car had made. Sound. A cry. Low. Throated. Delivered in fear. A harsh slap followed, then another, and another. A scream was formed, then swallowed, broken, echoing off into silence. Bourne got out of the car silently, the gun in his right hand, the flashlight awkward in the bloody fingers of his left. He walked toward the obscure black shape, each step, each limp, a study in silence. What he saw first was what he had seen last when the small sedan had disappeared in the shadows of the Stepdeckstrasse. The shining metal of the twisted chrome bumper. It glistened now in the night light. Four slaps in rapid succession, flesh against flesh, blows maniacally administered, received with muted screams of terror. Cries terminated, gasps permitted, thrashing movement part of it all. Inside the car. Jason crouched as best he could, sidestepping around the trunk toward the right rear window. He rose slowly, then suddenly, using sound as a weapon of shock, shouted as he switched on the powerful flashlight. You move, you're dead! What he saw inside filled him with revulsion and fury. Marie Saint-Jacques' clothes were torn away, shredded into strips. Hands were poised like claws on her half-naked body, kneading her breasts, separating her legs. The executioner's organ protruded from the cloth of his trousers. He was inflicting the final indignity before he carried out the sentence of death. Get out, you son of a bitch! There was a massive shattering of glass. The man raping Marie Saint-Jacques saw the obvious. Bourne could not fire the gun for fear of killing the woman. He had spun off her, crashing the heel of his shoe into the window of the small car. Glass flew out, sharp fragments blanketing Jason's face. He closed his eyes, limping backward to avoid the spray. The door swung open. A blinding spit of light accompanied the explosion. Hot, searing pain spread through Bourne's right side. The fabric of his coat was blown away, blood matting what remained of his shirt. He squeezed the trigger, only vaguely able to see the figure rolling on the ground. He fired again, the bullet detonating the surface of the asphalt. The executioner had rolled and lurched out of sight, into the darker blackness, unseen. Jason knew he could not stay where he was. To do so was his own execution. He raced, dragging his leg to the cover of the open door. "Stay inside," he yelled to Marie Saint-Jacques. The woman had started to move in panic. "God damn it! Stay in there!" A gunshot. The bullet embedded in the metal of the door. A running figure was silhouetted above the wall. Bourne fired twice, grateful for an expulsion of breath in the distance. He had wounded the man. He had not killed him. But the executioner would function less well than he had 60 seconds ago. Lights. Dim lights. Squared. Frames. What was it? What were they? He looked to the left and saw what he could not possibly have seen before. A small brick structure, some kind of dwelling by the seawall. Lights had been turned on inside. A watchman's station. Someone inside had heard the gunshots.
Was ist los? Wer ist da?
The shouts came from the figure of a man, a bent-over old man standing in a lighted doorway. Then the beam of a flashlight pierced the blacker darkness. Bourne followed it with his eyes, hoping it would shine on the executioner. It did. He was crouched by the wall. Jason stood up and fired. At the sound of his gun, the beam swung over to him. He was the target. Two shots came from the darkness, a bullet ricocheting off a metal strip in the window. Steel punctured his neck. Blood erupted. Racing footsteps. The executioner was running toward the source of the light.
Nine!
He had reached it. The figure in the doorway was lashed by an arm that was both his leash and his cage. The beam went out. In the light of the windows, Jason could see the killer pulling the watchman away, using the old man as a shield, dragging him back into darkness. Bourne watched until he could see no more, his gun raised helplessly over the hood. As he was helpless. His body draining. There was a final shot, followed by a guttural cry and once again racing footsteps. The executioner had carried out a sentence of death, not with the condemned woman, but with an old man. He was running. He had made his escape. Bourne could run no longer. The pain had finally immobilized him, his vision too blurred, his sense of survival exhausted. He lowered himself to the pavement. There was nothing. He simply did not care. Whatever he was, let it be. Let it be. The Saint-Jacques woman crawled out of the car, holding her clothes, every move made in shock. She stared at Jason, disbelief, horror, and confusion coming together in her eyes. "Go on," he whispered, hoping she could hear him.
"There's a car back there. The keys are in it. Get out of here. He may bring others, I don't know." "You came for me," she said, her voice echoing through a tunnel of bewilderment.
"Get out.
Get in that car and go like hell, doctor. If anyone tries to stop you, run him down. Reach the police. Real ones. With uniforms, you damn fool."
His throat was so hot, his stomach so cold. Fire and ice. He'd felt them before, together.
"Where was it?" "You saved my life,"
she continued in that hollow tone, the words floating in the air.
"You came for me. You came back for me and saved my life."
"Don't make it what it wasn't."
"You are incidental, doctor. You are a reflex, an instinct born of forgotten memories, conduits electrically prodded by stress. You see, I know the words. I don't care anymore. I hurt. Oh, my God, I hurt. You were free. You could have kept going, but you didn't. You came back for me."
He heard her through mists of pain. He saw her, and what he saw was unreasonable. As unreasonable as the pain. She was kneeling beside him, touching his face, touching his head.
"Stop it. Do not touch my head. Leave me."
"Why did you do that?"
It was her voice, not his. She was asking him a question.
Didn't she understand?
He could not answer her.
What was she doing?
She had torn a piece of cloth and was wrapping it around his neck. And now another, this larger, part of her dress. She had loosened his belt and was pushing the soft, smooth cloth down into the boiling hot skin on his right hip.
"It wasn't you."
He found words and used them quickly. He wanted the peace of darkness, as he had wanted it before but could not remember when. He could find it if she left him.
"That man. He'd seen me. He could identify me. It was him. I wanted him. Now get out."
"So could half a dozen others," she replied,
another note in her voice.
"I don't believe you."
"Believe me."
She was standing above him now. Then she was not there. She was gone. She had left him. The peace would come quickly now. He would be swallowed up in the dark, crashing waters, and the pain would be washed away. He leaned back against the car and let himself drift with the currents of his mind. A noise intruded. A motor, rolling and disruptive. He did not care for it. It interfered with the freedom of his own particular sea. Then a hand was on his arm. Then another, gently pulling him up.
"Come on," said the voice. "Help me."
"Let go of me."
The command was shouted. He had shouted it. But the command was not obeyed. He was appalled. Commands should be obeyed. Yet not always. Something told him that. The wind was there again, but not a wind in Zurich, in some other place, high in the night sky. And a signal came. A light flashed on, and he leaped up, whipped by furious new currents.
"All right. You're all right," said the maddening voice that would not pay attention to his commands. "Lift your foot up. Lift it. That's right. You did it. Now inside the car. Ease yourself back. Slowly. That's right."
He was falling. Falling in the pitch black sky. And then the falling stopped. Everything stopped. And there was stillness. He could hear his own breathing. And footsteps. He could hear footsteps. And the sound of a door closing, followed by the rolling, disruptive noise beneath him, in front of him, somewhere. Motion, swaying in circles. Balance was gone, and he was falling again, only to be stopped again. Another body against his body, a hand holding him, lowering him. His face felt cool. And then he felt nothing. He was drifting again. Currents gentler now. Darkness complete. There were voices above him, in the distance, but not so far away. Shapes came slowly into focus, lit by the spill of table lamps. He was in a fairly large room, and on a bed, a narrow bed, blankets covering him. Across the room were two people, a man in an overcoat and a woman dressed in a dark red skirt beneath a white blouse. Dark red. As the hair was. The Saint-Jacques woman? It was she, standing by a door talking to a man holding a leather bag in his left hand. They were speaking French.
"Rest, mainly," the man was saying. "If you're not accessible to me, anyone can remove the sutures. They can be taken out in a week, I'd guess."
"Thank you, doctor."
"Thank you. You've been most generous. I'll go now. Perhaps I'll hear from you. Perhaps not."
The doctor opened the door and let himself out. When he was gone, the woman reached down and slid the bolt in place. She turned and saw Bourne looking at her. She walked slowly, cautiously toward the bed.
"Can you hear me?" she asked.
He nodded.
"You're hurt," she said. "Quite badly. But if you stay quiet, it won't be necessary for you to get to a hospital." "That was a doctor."
"Obviously.
I paid him out of the money I found on you. Quite a bit more than might seem usual, but I was told he could be trusted. It was your idea, incidentally. While we were driving, you kept saying you had to find a doctor, one you could pay to keep quiet. You were right. It wasn't difficult."
"Where are we?" He could hear his voice. It was weak, but he could hear it.
"A village called Lenzburg, about 20 miles outside of Zurich. The doctor's from Fohlen. It's a nearby town. He'll see you in a week, if you're here."
"How?" He tried to raise himself, but the strength wasn't there. She touched his shoulder. It was an order to lie back down.
"I'll tell you what happened, and perhaps that will answer your questions. At least I hope so, because if it doesn't, I'm not sure I can."
She stood motionless, looking down at him, her tone controlled.
"An animal was raping me, after which he had orders to kill me. There was no way I was going to live. In the Stepdeckstrasse, you tried to stop them, and when you couldn't, you told me to scream, to keep screaming. It was all you could do. And by shouting to me, you risked being killed at that moment yourself. Later, you somehow got free. I don't know how, but I know you were hurt very badly doing so. And you came back to find me."
"Him," interrupted Jason. "I wanted him."
"You told me that. And I'll say what I said before. I don't believe you. Not because you're a poor liar, but because it doesn't conform with the facts. I work with statistics, Mr. Washburn or Mr. Bourne or whatever your name is. I respect observable data and I can spot inaccuracies. I'm trained to do that. Two men went in that building to find you, and I heard you say they were both alive. They could identify you. And there's the owner of the Dry Alpenhauser. He could too. Those are the facts, and you know them as well as I do. No. You came back to find me. You came back and saved my life."
"Go on," he said, his voice gaining strength. "What happened?"
"I made a decision. It was the most difficult decision I've ever made in my life. I think a person can only make a decision like that if he's nearly lost his life by an act of violence, his life saved by someone else. I decided to help you. Only for a while. For just a few hours, perhaps. But I would help you get away."
"Why didn't you go to the police?"
"I almost did. And I'm not sure I can tell you why I didn't. Maybe it was the rape, I don't know. I'm being honest with you. I've always been told it's the most horrible experience a woman can go through. I believe it now. And I heard the anger, the disgust in your own voice when you shouted at him. I'll never forget that moment as long as I live, as much as I may want to."
"The police?" he repeated.
"That man at the Dry Alpenhauser said the police were looking for you. That a telephone number had been set up in Zurich."
She paused.
"I couldn't give you to the police. Not then. Not after what you did."
"Knowing what I am?" he asked.
"I know only what I've heard. And what I've heard doesn't correspond with the injured man who came back for me and offered his life for mine."
"That's not very bright."
"That's the one thing I am, Mr. Bourne.
I assume it's born is what he called you. Very bright. I hit you. I threatened to kill you. If I'd been you, and men were trying to kill me, I probably would have done the same, if I were capable. So you drove out of Zurich? Not at first. Not for a half hour or so. I had to calm down, reach my decision. I'm methodical. I'm beginning to see that. I was a wreck, a mess. I needed clothes, hairbrush, makeup. I couldn't walk anywhere. I found a telephone booth down by the river, and there was no one around, so I got out of the car and called a colleague at the hotel. The Frenchman? The Belgian? Interrupted Jason. No. They'd been at the Bertinelli lecture, and if they had recognized me up on the stage with you, I assumed they'd given my name to the police. Instead, I called a woman who's a member of our delegation. She loathes Bertinelli and was in her room. We worked together for several years, and we're friends. I told her that if she heard anything about me to disregard it, I was perfectly all right. As a matter of fact, if anyone asked about me, she was to say I was with a friend for the evening. For the night, if pressed, that I'd left the Bertinelli lecture early. Methodical, said Bourne. Yes. Marie allowed herself a tentative smile. I asked her to go to my room. We're only two doors away from each other, and the night maid knows we're friends. If no one was there, she wants to put some clothes and makeup in my suitcase and come back to her room. I'd call her in 5 minutes. She just accepted what you said. I told you, we're friends. She knew I was all right. Excited, perhaps, but all right. And that I wanted her to do as I asked. Marie paused again. She probably thought I was telling her the truth. Go ahead. I called her back, and she had my things. Which means the other two delegates didn't give your name to the police. Your room would have been watched, sealed off. I don't know whether they did or not. But if they did, my friend was probably questioned quite a while ago. She'd simply say what I told her to say. She was at the Carillon. You were down at the river. How did you get your things?
It was quite simple. A little tacky, but simple. She spoke to the night maid, telling her I was avoiding one man at the hotel, seeing another outside. I needed my overnight case, and could she suggest a way to get it to me? To an automobile, down at the river. An off-duty waiter brought it to me.
Wasn't he surprised at the way you looked?
He didn't have much of a chance to see anything. I opened the trunk, stayed in the car, and told him to put it in the back. I left a 10-franc note on the spare tire.
You're not methodical. You're remarkable.
Methodical will do.
How did you find the doctor?
Right here.
The concierge, or whatever he's called in Switzerland. Remember, I'd wrapped you up as best I could, reduced the bleeding as much as possible.
Like most people, I have a working knowledge of first aid.
That meant I had to remove some of your clothing.
I found the money, and then I understood what you meant by finding a doctor you could pay. You have thousands and thousands of dollars on you. I know the rates of exchange.
That's only the beginning.
What?
Never mind. He tried to rise again. It was too difficult.
Aren't you afraid of me?
Afraid of what you've done?
Of course I am. But I know what you did for me.
You're more trusting than I'd be under the circumstances.
Then perhaps you're not that aware of the circumstances. You're still very weak, and I have the gun. Besides, you don't have any clothes.
None?
Not even a pair of shorts. I've thrown everything away.
You'd look a little foolish running down the street in a plastic money belt. Bourne laughed through his pain, remembering La Ciotat and the Marquis de Chamfort. Methodical, he said.
Very.
What happens now?
I've written out the name of the doctor and paid a week's rent for the room. The concierge will bring you meals starting at noon today.
I'll stay here until mid-morning.
It's nearly 6 o'clock. It should be light soon.
Then I'll return to the hotel for the rest of my things and my airline tickets, and do my best to avoid any mention of you. Suppose you can't. Suppose you were identified.
I'll deny it. It was dark. The whole place was in panic.
Now you're not being methodical. At least not as methodical as the Zurich police would be. I've got a better way. Call your friend and tell her to pack the rest of your clothes and settle your bill. Take as much money as you want from me and grab the first plane to Canada. It's easier to deny long distance. She looked at him in silence, then nodded.
That's very tempting.
It's very logical. She continued to stare at him a moment longer, the tension inside her building conveyed by her eyes. She turned away and walked to the window, looking out at the earliest rays of the morning sun. He watched her, feeling the intensity, knowing its roots, seeing her face in the pale orange glow of dawn. There was nothing he could do. She had done what she felt she had to do because she had been released from terror. From a kind of terrible degradation no man could really understand. From death. And in doing what she did, she had broken all the rules. She whipped her head toward him, her eyes glaring.
Who are you?
You heard what they said.
I know what I saw. What I feel.
Don't try to justify what you did. You simply did it, that's all. Let it be.
Let it be. Oh, God, you could have let me be, and there would have been peace. But now you have given part of my life back to me, and I've got to struggle again, face it again.
Suddenly she was standing at the foot of the bed, the gun in her hand. She pointed it at him, and her voice trembled.
Should I undo it, then? Should I call the police and tell them to come and take you?
A few hours ago I would have said go ahead. I can't bring myself to say it now.
Then who are you?
They say my name is Bourne. Jason Charles Bourne.
What does that mean? They say.
He stared at the gun, at the dark circle of its barrel. There was nothing left but the truth. As he knew the truth.
What does it mean? He repeated.
You know almost as much as I do, Doctor.
What?
You might as well hear it. Maybe it'll make you feel better. Or worse, I don't know. But you may as well. Because I don't know what else to tell you. She lowered the gun.
Tell me what?
My life began 5 months ago on a small island in the Mediterranean called Île de Port Noir. The sun had risen to the midpoint of the surrounding trees, its rays filtered by wind-blown branches, streaming through the windows and mottling the walls with irregular shapes of light. Bourne lay back on the pillow, exhausted. He had finished. There was nothing more to say. Marie sat across the room in a leather armchair, her legs curled up under her, cigarettes and the gun on a table to her left. She had barely moved, her gaze fixed on his face. Even when she smoked, her eyes never wavered, never left his. She was a technical analyst, evaluating data, filtering facts as the trees filtered the sunlight.
"You kept saying it,"
she said softly, spacing out her next words.
I don't know. I wish I knew. You'd stare at something, and I was frightened. I'd ask you, what was it?
What were you going to do? And you'd say it again. I wish I knew. My God, what you've been through. What you're going through. After what I've done to you, you can even think about what's happened to me. They're two separate lines of occurrence, she said absently, frowning in thought. Separate. Related in origin, developed independently. That's economics nonsense. And then on the Löwenstrasse, just before we went up to Czernak's flat, I begged you not to make me go with you. I was convinced that if I heard any more, you'd kill me. That's when you said the strangest thing of all. You said, what you heard makes no more sense to me than it does to you. Perhaps less. I thought you were insane. What I've got is a form of insanity. A sane person remembers. I don't. Why didn't you tell me Czernak tried to kill you? There wasn't time, and I didn't think it mattered. It didn't at that moment. To you. It did to me. Why? Because I was holding on to an outside hope that you wouldn't fire your gun at someone who hadn't tried to kill you first. But he did. I was wounded. I didn't know the sequence. You didn't tell me. I don't understand. Marie lit a cigarette. It's hard to explain, but during all the time you kept me hostage, even when you hit me and dragged me and pressed the gun into my stomach and held it against my head, God knows I was terrified. But I thought I saw something in your eyes. Call it reluctance. It's the best I can come up with. It'll do. What's your point? I'm not sure. Perhaps it goes back to something else you said in the booth at the Dry Alpenhauser. That fat man was coming over and you told me to stay against the wall, cover my face with my hand. For your own good, you said. There's no point in his being able to identify you. There wasn't. For your own good. That's not the reasoning of a pathological killer. I think I held on to that. For my own sanity, maybe. That, and the look in your eyes. I still don't get the point. The man with the gold-rimmed glasses who convinced me he was the police said you were a brutal killer who had to be stopped before he killed again. Had it not been for Czernak, I wouldn't have believed him. On either point. The police don't behave like that. They don't use guns in dark, crowded places. And you were a man running for your life. Are running for your life. But you're not a killer. Bourne held up his hand. Forgive me. But that strikes me as a judgment based on false gratitude. You say you have a respect for facts. Then look at them. I repeat. You heard what they said. Regardless of what you think you saw and feel, you heard the words. Boiled down, envelopes were filled with money and delivered to me to fulfill certain obligations. I'd say those obligations were pretty clear, and I accepted them. I had a numbered account at the Gemeinschaft Bank totaling about 5